Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name's Craig Forces, and I'm here with Stephanie Carvin, high above the once frozen, now temporarily melted, but soon to be frozen again, Rideau River. And we're back in the saddle, Stephanie, here in early January, and this is our first podcast for 2018.
Yeah, Happy New Year, everybody. It's we had a great time in 2017, and looking forward to 2018. And I have to say, I want to thank everyone for... We got a lot of nice comments over the holidays, over our podcast, so glad you're enjoying. Always feel free to say so in the Apple, iTunes store if you can. But other than that, it's a great way to kick off 2018 by acknowledging just how great you guys have been with your feedback.
And we've got some plans as to where we want to take this podcast. So one of the things we're looking at doing for 2018 is to start inviting guests, persons who work in national security, the intelligence and security community, to say a few words about what they do and their functions and a day in the life. And along the way, for those who come on board, we've got some bling.
There's new bling. You'll see it on the, I'll put it on the Twitter account. You can see it at Intrepid Podcast.
So we've got these great little pens that we'll give to our guests, which have a picture of William Stevenson himself, the Intrepid himself, working on an early podcast recorder, it looks like. and the good quality pens. So they were inspired. These are the same pens, the same make of pen, I believe, that I got from the National Security Parliamentary Review Committee in Norway. And they were great pens. They were so good. They lasted a good time, but they were big, thick, bulky things. And every time I went through security, for whatever reason, I had to pull them out, which I thought was deeply ironic.
So we've gotten problematic security-wise pens for our National Security Podcast. That makes sense. The other thing to look forward to for us, and certainly for you guys in 2018, is Craig, myself, and another colleague, Tomas, we were given an SSHRC, that's a Social Science Humanities Research Council, grant to do a study on the Canadian intelligence community. What does it actually look like? What is it? You know, I don't know if there's ever really been a map of the intelligence community that's been done. So that's something that we're working on. And so as a result of that, we're going to have a big conference in May. And in addition, we may have some of the speakers from that conference come on the show. We may even tape some of the sessions from the conference for you to enjoy. So lots to look forward to in 2018.
What are we talking about today?
Well, I think we're going to start off by talking about the public safety report that came out in December of 2017, kind of after we finished our last show. The annual public report on the terrorist threat to Canada. We're going to talk, I think, about some of the UK reports as well. So
yeah, December was busy for reports.
There was a lot of reporting. I don't know if that's because people enjoy reading intelligence reports by their holiday setup or their gear or their menorah, their tree. But there was a lot to get through. So we need to kind of catch up.
And then we're going to turn our attention to 2018 and look forward to issues that might arise over the next couple of months. We may be able to deal with that in a single podcast. If not, we'll divide it into two. But we wanted to update our listeners on some of the trials that we've mentioned from time to time over the course of 2017, and so mostly terrorism trials. Looking also to some new cases that are on the horizon. I think we wanted to say a few words about the National Security Committee of Parliament as well, in terms of the functions we might envisage it playing in terms of its substantive review going forward.
Right. So a lot to get to. So shall we get to it?
Sure. So, Stephanie, we've just spent the last, 6 weeks grading. what grade would you give the 2017?
Was it only 6 weeks, right? Yeah, right. For what grade would I give to 2017 generally?
No, the 2017 Public Safety Terrorism Threat to Canada report.
Okay, so that's a good place to start. Because I think when I first read it, I kind of skimmed it. It was the end of term, and as you said, I was staring down Marking Mountain. And I was kind of cranky, so I would have given it, I guess, a B-. And a B- in here in grad school, and I think at U of O as well, is basically the bare pass. So I reread it recently and for the podcast, and I'm a little less critical than I was, so I think I'm going to move it to a B from a B-. Basically, it really did have the feel of reading a government website. I didn't really feel that there was that much information that was given. More disturbingly, Canada last year in January, you know, almost a year ago, we had the biggest terrorist attack on Canadian soil or against Canadians since really Air India. You could say the biggest attack would have been 9/11, where I think just over 20 Canadians were killed. But this was a major terror attack. Whether or not it was legally such, or whether or not there were terrorism charges in Quebec City. And that didn't even really merit a discussion, even in the introduction, right. The executive summary. And that was, I think, very poorly done. And I think it still shows we have a way to go in shifting our mindset and how we think about extremist violence in Canada. So that was also a very big letdown. And I have to think that, you know, if that attack had been conducted by a Islamic State inspired individual against a church, I mean, it would have been on the cover. Like, it would have been just a game changer. So I think that, to me, was very, very unfortunate. So I think for those two reasons, the fact that a lot of the report did read like a kind of overview of just what the government does. It didn't feel particularly original. It felt like I was reading a government website. And then secondly, and again, more disturbingly, the lack of mentioning of Quebec City, which I think got two small mentions kind of buried in the document.
Yeah, and I'd agree. I thought it was fairly cookie cutter. It was largely qualitative. There were very few data points. We'll talk about some of them in a second. There are a handful of data points. And there was a fair amount of recycling from prior iterations of the report. And so I didn't feel that I came away with a greater sense of either the threat environment or a better sense, frankly, as to what the government actually is doing in response, except in very oblique and general terms. The one area where I thought there was an appreciable improvement over the 2016 report. So one of the concerns I've had in the past is the proliferation of terminology. And so in the past, there's been references to extremist travelers. That term is recycled here, but there's more definitional precision. And so here, they specify that an extremist traveler is suspected as having engaged in terrorist activity. That's different from last year. Last year, they talked about terrorism-related activities. Mm. Now, that seems like a distinction without a difference, but the difference really is that terrorist activity is a legally understood term in the criminal code. So my assumption is that when they're talking about extremist travelers, they're talking about people who are suspected of having engaged in the legally understood concept of terrorist activity, which gives us more precision than might have been the case in the past. Now, there's some slippage there. I mean, they sort of revert back to terrorism-related activities at various points in the report, which I think is unfortunate. Where I think there is more precision on the data than has been in the case in the past is this perennial discussion as to number of extremist travelers who have gone overseas and number of returnees.
Oh, I hope we get to talk about this again.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just doesn't go away, right? So the key passage says there are currently over 190 extremists with a nexus to Canada who are abroad, including in Iraq and Syria, and just over 60 extremists have returned to Canada. Now, what's notable here is I think there's been a presumption, at least in the popular mind, that those 60 are all former ISIS fighters who are returnees. And of course, that's never been the case.
No.
And this report offers some clarification. And so they say slightly more than half of the extremists who are abroad are in Turkey, Syria, or Iraq. Only a relatively small number of returnees are from that region. But the majority of those who have returned from Turkey, Syria, or Iraq are suspected to have engaged in combat. Now, I mean, I find that sort of torturous. I think it boils down to the majority of those who have returned from Iraq, Syria, or Turkey are suspected to have been combatants, but the returnees from those three countries are a minority of all the extremist returnees.
Yes.
All right. So what does that translate it into in terms of numbers? Less than 30. It has to be less than 30, just if you do the math. Probably closer to the number that we've seen thrown around of from people like Amar and
yeah, Amar Singham. He's suggested that the number of actual violence, of people who engage in violence, is probably closer to 10.
Right.
Right.
Who are returnees.
Yes. So, and the issue there, again, is like, you know, I think people think that last month 60 people came back from Iraq, Syria, as you say, and politicians are playing very fast and loose with the facts here, and it's unfortunate. It's also unfortunate because, you know, a lot of people in government don't seem to be able to get the numbers straight themselves. But actually, I would say probably the majority of the 60 probably came back prior to 2015, 2016.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, those are people who've been back. You'll notice there's no timeline on there. And that's one of the curious things about the numbers is with returnees is that they don't stipulate, like, so have they been back here for 20 years? Have they been back here for 10 years? Have they been back for 5 years? It's not clear to me when that comes back because, you know, I mean, it's just those numbers still aren't as clear as I think they could be for Canadians.
And the sentence structure here doesn't help that much.
It does not.
It requires some parsing.
But now, it's a little torturous, and I think they want to be super careful, but right. In doing so, they also make it unclear.
So some of the things I don't like so much here. So there's a passage, page 19, for those of you who have the document in front of you or following along. When an individual returns to Canada after supporting a terrorist group abroad, they may be charged and convicted of a terrorism offense and sentenced to prison. No, support is not the standard, right? Membership is not the standard. Support is not the standard. It's participation in a terrorist group. That's the crime. And the participation has to be to enhance capacity to engage in terrorist activity. And so it's misleading to suggest that mere support is enough. Because it suggests that convictions should be more easily obtained than really they are, because the law is more demanding than mere support. So these little things, I think, give rise to some uncertainty in the public mind, and I think feed into this idea that perhaps the government hasn't been as active in bringing prosecutions where it should be. And yeah. We know, incidentally, this is the other objection I have, there are no numbers, right? There's lots of data out there that they could pull together to show what the government has been doing in this space. So there have been... There's one conviction in relation to a returnee. That's the Kevin Muhammad case that we've talked about in this podcast right. in the past. He was convicted in relation not to ISIS, but al-Nusra. But there are two cases ongoing that the government keeps invoking for returnees from ISIS. And those two cases involve accusations of travel for the purpose of participation with a terrorist group. That's not really, there's not much information on that. More than that, there are four outstanding in absentia warrants in relation to at least some people who are probably dead. But there's some activity there that could be recounted in this report. And then on top of that, there's a whole bunch of data that they could be pulling into this report that's already publicly available to give us a better sense as to what the government's up to. So, for example, CSIS warrant information. We've talked about this. It's reported in the back of the CIRC annual report. The number of targets is also reported, and we noted in the past that the number of targets has actually gone down. Mm-hmm. And those targets, incidentally, are for all threat-related activities, not just terrorism. And so one thing this report could do is it could pull out the target data and provide us with a timeline to show number of targets with the passage of time, because that information is pretty much publicly available anyway. Other examples, the RCMP issues press releases in relation to arrests and outcomes. None of that information is pulled in. The annual report on RCMP's use of law enforcement justification provisions, and so this is when the police are entitled through authorization to violate law, sources, for example, or undercover agents violate law. There's an annual report that's put out. What's interesting this year is there were no authorizations given for terrorism offense cases, the first time in a number of years. That's interesting in terms of understanding the threat environment. Same too with Part 6 wiretaps. There's a significant downswing in terms of the number of wiretaps that were issued for terrorism investigations over the last year. Again, important data that's publicly available that could be contained in an annex here. And then I guess the last point I'll make here in terms of available data on top of these other reports is the Public Prosecution Service of Canada. You can look at their 2017-2018 departmental plan, and it says that there are 8 individuals who are currently being prosecuted for terrorism offenses. There's one prosecution for Security of Information Act offense. There are charges outstanding against an additional 9 individuals who are not in Canada. And that's the sort of information, the concrete sort of information that should be pulled into a report like this.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm going to be dead honest with you. Because of my background working with the government, I used to work on these. I gave input to doing. So I'm familiar with the process of how this is actually made. And it's really, there's some poor analyst sometimes at, it varies. There's no consistent process. Sometimes it's been done through ITAC. Sometimes it's been done by public safety itself. So it's not clear to me who actually had the lead pen on this particular document. But basically, they are in charge of putting out what they think the priorities as relates to the public threat. And so these people are very much meshed in the world of, okay, what's actually going on? They're not really paying attention to the warrants. They're not really paying attention to those other things that you're talking about. Now, that being said, I think that, you know, those are all important things that could be included. And I think, you know, this is something that we should be encouraging this, because actually I think it paints a really interesting picture and a better picture of what the threat actually is. But given the nature of this, that again, you get some poor schmuck analyst who's tasked with writing this, and then you have basically 30 agencies that come in and poop on it. Yeah.
Right. So there's no reason why they couldn't pull together all this information and include it in an annex. It would serve two purposes. First of all, it would give us a better sense, an empirical sense, as to the threat environment reflected in the actual activities of the security services. More than that, it would not leave us with the impression that the government's waffling on these issues. If you have this kind of activity in terms of prosecutions and the like, it should be part of the public record so that it's not us, you and I, who are trying to pour through this information and say, look, actually, the government's got a point of view that's not actually being concretely communicated in these standardized reports.
Yeah, I guess it just goes to show, like, you know, it's not clear what this report is supposed to do. Is it supposed to be about the threat, or is it supposed to be about, like, oh, look what the government's doing? And I think, you know, so I think if when you put the emphasis on the threat, that's what analysts are going to focus on. I think you do raise a good point, though. But whether or not that information belongs in this document, you know, but this is the okay. So then this gets to the whole thing. It's like clearly the government is trying to do both, because the second half of the document is this thing called the Federal Terrorism Response Plan, which we'll talk about in just a second. So they're obviously keen to talk about what they're doing, but why they don't want to show what they've done is strange. But, you know, is this supposed to be a threat report, or is this supposed to be a response? And are we actually linking those two things together? It's not clear to me. But again, like the way these things are constructed, I'm not surprised that information isn't there. But, you know, let's encourage them to do better next time.
Yeah. So did you want to say a few more words about this report? Because I want to juxtapose it with the UK reports that came out in December, especially Intelligence and Security Committee reports.
Well, I think there there's, I guess, two more things that I want to, maybe three more things quickly to talk about. One is, I was kind of surprised, like, there's all these kind of weird context boxes in there, and, like, you picked up one mistake with regards to this, support with regards to terrorism and being charged. I was very unhappy with their ISIS history, they call it Daesh. I don't like calling it that because I think I pronounce it very badly. but they talk about the creation of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which led to the foundation of the Islamic State. No, that's kind of a B. That's not an A-plus history. And I don't even understand why that context box is even there. But basically, you know, Zarqawi had his own group. His joining of Al-Qaeda in Iraq wasn't, you know, really a joining. It was kind of like an arrangement of convenience that happened. They fought the whole time that they were actually an alliance, and then they split up. It's not really a great history. So I'm kind of like, why are you even doing this in this document? That's not what this document should be about. So these kinds of weird kind of factual errors kind of take away, I think, from the document. The second thing, and this is a little bit different, did you notice the references to encryption in the document? There's actually quite a few places where the document notes how troublesome encryption is.
Right.
And I'm like, is this hinting towards a new policy that's going to be coming out this year in 2018? You know, because we do know that there's been some discussion back in the Five Eyes ministerial they had back in the summer of this year. They were definitely talking about what should be done about encryption. Should there be a backdoor? And we note that Canada's position is not yet entirely clear on that. So it was that a hint towards a policy change that we should be looking forward to.
That was all over the green paper too, the consultation in advance of C-59.
Right. So I think something will be coming out. But again, my understanding is that there's not a consensus view in the intelligence community in Canada that,
because there's no perfect solution.
There's no perfect solution. CSE recognizes the danger, but law enforcement agencies like the RCMP are kind of more gung-ho for this, right? And the final thing, and I think this segues into what you want to talk about, is the discussion as what I just said about the Federal Terrorism Response Plan. And this is interesting for me because I teach critical infrastructure protection and the threats to critical infrastructure. And one of them, of course, is terrorism. And one of the things we talk about a lot is, well, who's in charge of responding? Because there's municipal, provincial, and federal levels. So we know that there, so they kind of set out, okay, well, we have a response plan. They don't really show us the plan. They say, well, here's different agencies that might be doing some things. So it'll be interesting to see if they actually eventually publish that. But in the first instance, I would say it's not clear how the federal government will be working with the provinces and municipality. They acknowledge it as an issue that, you know, we have to work out how, you know, the at what point does the local police have a role? At what point then does the provincial authorities have a role? And then what point does the federal government have a role? And of course, they do have the lead for major terrorism incidents. So it's not, they didn't really set it out, or I'm not sure if they have worked it out. I will also note that the action plan for critical infrastructure expired last year. It was 2014 to 2017. So I don't know if we're going to have a new plan for critical infrastructure, or whether this federal terrorism response plan is actually supposed to be it. But if it's not public, that's not very helpful. And finally, I would say it's actually really hard to evaluate this because we don't actually have a lot of knowledge about what went wrong during previous incidents. Right. So we don't, you know, the full report of the Ottawa attack in October 2014 was never released. So we don't know if, you know, even if we do ever get the full federal terrorism response plan document, we won't know if it's a good response because we don't know what went wrong fully the last time.
Yeah. And actually, that's a good point to segue into the UK.
Yes.
Right. So a couple of reports came out in the UK in December, not least some reports out of their review bodies. But the two reports that I think probably we should focus on are the report from the UK Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliamentarians, which is their equivalent to our now National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians, their annual report, the ISC's annual report. And then also David Anderson, who was the former independent reviewer of anti-terrorism law. He did a report reviewing the after-action assessments by the intelligence and security services in the wake of the terrorist acts in the United Kingdom in 2017. And so it was an independent review of internal reviews from which then he made some extrapolations and observations. He was essentially peer reviewing, if you will, the internal reviews to ground truth them. So in terms of the ISC, so what is it that stood out for me for the ISC report? Well, detail, 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 data, data, data with redactions. So first of all, it's not just terrorism, right? So there's a big section on cyber, which I thought was really interesting. There's a discussion of intelligence service priorities. And so those are efficacy issues that are really not addressed independently anywhere in Canada, let alone in a manner that allows us to read it. There's a big discussion of countering hostile foreign state activities in the UK by countries, naming individual countries. Again, extremely informative. And if the UK can do it, why can't we, in terms of questions of confidentiality and diplomatic fallout? And then on terrorism, there's lots of hard, meaningful data. And so, for example, MI5 informed the committee that as of April 2017, it was running approximately 500 current investigations into individuals or groups associated with Islamist terrorism. 500. That's a big number, right?
It's a big number,
it's
yeah.
A concrete number, though. And then also in terms of subjects of interest, 3,000 subjects of interest as part of a broader pool of something like 20,000 who had at one point or another been subjects of interest. And then there's a discussion of tripwires and circumstances where persons who may have been a subject of interest re-engage the attention of the security services, as well as some understanding of the risk assessment process that MI5 employs. In other words, a lot of concrete detail that I haven't seen replicated anywhere in a Canadian context. And so right away, it juxtaposes very poorly with the 2017 report we just talked about. Now, moving to David Anderson's report, lots of discussion there in David Anderson's report about interagency operational matters, which are also found in the ISC report. And so how well do MI6, MI5, police, GCHQ, how well do they work together, which is a perennial issue
yes.
for them as for us in terms of our equivalence. But the other thing that I thought was really notable about David Anderson's report is the very fact that it exists, right? And so this is your point. The 2014 attacks... What we've seen a redacted version of the OPP's assessment of policing on the Hill, but we haven't seen any of the after action reports that were presumably done by police, by CSIS. We haven't seen any of that, even though equivalents in Australia and the UK, they're public documents. And there's lessons learned then that are shared, not just internally in the intelligence community, but also publicly. And so you can assess the extent to which the state has responded appropriately in terms of remedying shortcomings that may have precipitated security risks. David Anderson's report suggests that the security services in the UK have done good reports on what went wrong, have acknowledged shortcomings, and then are been prepared to have their reports vetted by an external independent individual, David Anderson himself, mm-hmm. who essentially has said, here are some of the key takeaways. I have the impression that the in the UK, they're not in so much of gotcha environment as we are here, that the services are prepared to acknowledge mistakes and learn from them. Here, my impression is that it's sort of we're in a zero risk, zero tolerance atmosphere, and that if there's any revelation of weakness on the part of the security services or shortcomings, it's considered anathema. It's something that we really shouldn't be revealing publicly. And I think that's actually the wrong attitude to have if you want to be a learning institution. Maybe I'm wrong, but there isn't much evidence in Canada of any willingness to discuss lessons learned.
I think that's right, and I think that's unfortunate. And it also, you know, it gets to the whole issue of trust. And certainly we saw that in the Green Paper and the eventual follow-up and response, that people don't feel like they trust what's happening and what's going on. I mean, yeah, it in the end, I mean, the thing with the UK and Canada is we do have very different histories when it comes to dealing with terrorism and violent extremism. I mean, they've gone through, fortunately, Canada has not had the same experience as the UK with regards to Northern Ireland terrorism. There are issues with Islamist-inspired extremism tend to be much worse, and now they're also dealing with a very violent far-right movement as well. And they had a history of that as well in the 1980s. So I think because of that, there have been more public pressure for inquiries and reviews, which we don't necessarily see. After 7/7, the big attack in the UK, there was a very large push for an inquiry into what had happened, the response, and was it okay? And you know what? These things are resource intensive and difficult, but they're willing to put it out there, and it you know, it does lead to hopefully improvements in how things are done. So I don't know if it's the fact that we're unwilling or it's the fact we don't yet have the experiences that the UK have had that would lead us to doing some of these things. But this is where I hope, again, that we see the new committees start to take up some of the slack.
Well, yeah, and so we've had commissions of inquiry, but of course those commissions of inquiry, they're quasi-judicial, they're adversarial, they're incredibly expensive. And so that's very different from an internal lessons learned process that's self-reflective and allows us to make improvements and then is audited by an external observer. And frankly, it goes to efficacy review, right? So to the extent that our existing review bodies engage in propriety review, where they look at compliance with law and ministerial directive and aren't necessarily quite as engaged on questions of efficacy and efficiency and the ability of the services to work hand in glove with one another, that there's a huge gap. And so I agree with you. I mean, so one of the things we wanted to talk about here, maybe this is a segue into a conversation about the agenda for the National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians, what it should be doing. Now, right now, they've had several meetings all through the fall. They're stood up, as you may recall, listeners, we've talked about this, it's fully constituted. They now have staff, they have an executive director, and they've been, as I understand it, been briefed, learning a little bit about the intelligence community. So the question is, what are they going to look at? And so I actually have a short list of things that I think they should look at. Right.
Get
so this
some
is,
homework,
this
professor.
This would be my homework assignment if I was the master of the universe and decided what should be priorities. And I'm not sure that I would necessarily put these in order of priority, but I think that the four things that stand out for me is the idea of looking at the community as a whole, the security and intelligence community as a whole, and doing efficacy review about how well they operate one with each other.
Yes.
Which has not been done.
No.
Right.
That's a hugely important thing.
No fly.
Yep.
Right. So is the no-fly system, which is, of course, enormously controversial, is it worth its weight? I mean, is it worth it? Does it do anything?
There's actually defense of it in the public report on the terrorist threat.
So an independent assessment as to whether it does anything.
Right.
Okay. Intel evidence, right? It's got to come up, intel evidence, and it
Drink.
Will come up. So one of the things we'll be looking for in 2018,
yep.
The government held its consultation last summer on intelligence to evidence.
Right.
And its focus, its principal focus is on reform to the Canada Evidence Act, Section 38, which at some point we're going to have to explain and talk about, maybe when we talk about some of these cases that are percolating through the court system. All right, well, fine. So are we going to see some movement on that with Section 38 of the Canada Evidence Act? Are we going to see some deeper understanding as to how this is more than simply a legal issue, but also a question of how well the services shake hands culturally, right? So what are we going to see on that front? I think that the National Security Committee of Parliamentarians could perform our service in terms of really understanding the perspective of the different agencies and seeing the way possibly to solutions that aren't necessarily legislated solutions. The fourth thing I would put in is metadata collection, right? So one of the issues that came up in the U.S. was the efficacy of telephony metadata and the extent to which it provided any appreciable security benefit. And the results from the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board in the U.S. and a number of independent experts was that telephony metadata was completely useless in terms of its impact on security. And they dropped that program. They dropped the authorization under the FISA for NSA under 215 of the Patriot Act. They dropped that, 2 years ago? And so have we done an assessment as to these tools internally as to whether they're actually efficacious? Or do they actually make a difference? I'd like to see some effort by the National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians to take up that slack and say, hey, look, we have all these tools and the security services say that they're important. Well, okay, come to us in a classified environment and show us what gain you're getting from them.
Right. I would add just one thing to that list. I would endorse all of that. I think it sounds good. One would be HR practices.
Right. Yes. That would be on my list as well.
Yeah, human resources practices. But just because there's been the recent controversy, and I don't mean this as some kind of punitive thing. I mean this in the sense that basically human rights practices at CSIS in particular have taken a big punch to the guts, as it were, because of the recent scandal of racism and sexism and things like that.
And that case settled, by the way.
And that all settled. And that does not surprise me in the least, because I cannot see that going through a litigation that the service would particularly like. But I think one of the things that, I think it's good to look at HR practices generally. The service actually has its own recruiting, right? It has it's separate from the rest of the government of Canada. So I think, it's worth looking at. I think it's worth looking at how issues like mental health are being dealt with. You know, these people work under incredible stress, very stressful jobs. You need to have good mental health resources there and to make sure that's being done, to make sure that complaints are being done appropriately. Within, these organizations, there's a lot of issues. It's not just the service. I think this is also the military as well. But with regards to mobility, forcing people to move if they want to get promotions because the service is built off of an RCMP model that worked really well in the 1930s, but doesn't necessarily work well in 2018. So there's a lot there for, I think, the committee to look at. But there's no shortage of things for them to do. I think these would be great things for them to look at.
Yeah, and in fact, the ISC, the UK ISC, did a report on women in the intelligence sector. It's actually a very interesting read, again, from a human resources promotion, advancement, recruitment perspective. And I think that would be a very valuable contribution to our discussion here in Canada, not just gender, probably also how reflective of diversity are the services. And you've made this point before, that diversity is not just simply advancing diversity for its own sake, but as you've said, that the services themselves have to be reflective of the society, because ultimately in our society, security and intelligence depends on consent of the population.
Oh, absolutely. No, I can't emphasize that point strongly enough. I mean, communities need to see themselves reflected in their own security and intelligence organizations. Absolutely.
So we're at about 30 minutes now, Stephanie, and we still have lots of other things to talk about. So maybe we should just talk about one other thing that came up in the news for today, and then defer our discussion about things to look for in 2018, cases, developments in terms of law, to a second podcast. So the other thing that I noticed coming out in the news about a week, 2 weeks ago, was the consultant's report on CBSA and CBSA Review. So CBSA, Canada Border Services Agency, and the issue is to what sort of mechanism should there be for complaints and review. Now, I guess one thing to underscore is this is not solved by C-59. So as our listeners will know in our discussions, C-59 creates a new review body, the National Security and Intelligence Review Agency, but its remit will be confined to national security and intelligence. CBSA does a lot of things beyond national security and intelligence. And so the greater bulk of CBSA is now currently and will not, after C-59, be subject to any kind of independent review or independent complaints mechanism. And that's of some considerable concern. CBSA actually performs a law enforcement function. It's technically a law enforcement agency, as well as having an intelligence function of sorts. It's a border police, essentially. And it is, as far as I know, the only law enforcement body, so provincial, municipal, federal, that is not subject to at least some sort of independent review / oversight, which seems a remarkable omission.
Yeah.
And so what should be done there?
Right. So Mel Kapp, who's actually former civil servant. Clerk of the Privy Council. He was actually the UK High Commissioner from Canada when I was there. So that's how I know him. But He was commissioned basically to, he's actually now teaches at U of T, I think, but he was commissioned to write this report and did in fact recommend an agency and said, you know, this is something that we need to do. But this is something that I think came out like 6 months yeah. prior to us finding out about it in the media that, you know, this is
It
came out through ATIP.
Why?
I know. So it's one of these things where it's like, again, this is a good example of us being unwilling to have adult conversations about what would seem to be a very, I don't want to say benign thing, but a very important thing that we should have a public conversation about. Right. And this is not helpful. And, you know, I mean, you know, Trudeau government, you came out on this whole thing about transparency and everything like that. This is the kind of report that you should be releasing. And starting a national discussion, I promise you the government won't melt if you do that. So I think, you know, this is something that should be done. And as particularly as the our arrangements on the border with the United States are changing. And a lot of people are very concerned with what's happening with the Trump administration and kind of its very robust, to put it mildly, approach to border security. So,
especially because of the Preclearance Act passed Parliament.
Exactly. Yeah. So this whole preclearance issue is now going to be a serious issue. American authorities are going to have certain powers in Canada. So how are our...
They've had already, but this grosses up their powers.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I guess the question is, because if you go to an airport, you pass through U.S. customs on Canadian soil. Right. But like how is the CBSA cooperating with the United States? How are they passing on information? All these kinds of things. And people are going to want some kind of review of that. And, you know, this isn't necessarily our bread and butter per se, but I think, you know, it touches on a lot of the stuff that we talk about. And I don't see why we wouldn't do this. But more disturbingly, I just don't understand why this report wasn't released.
Yeah. Well, and the obvious solution is if you're taking away national security functions for the current Civilian Review and Complaints Commission of the RCMP and putting it in this new National Security Review Agency that's being created by C-59, you take that residual CRCC, the RCMP body, and you give it federal law enforcement jurisdiction that reaches now just not just the RCMP for review and complaints, but also CBSA, right?
So that's the easy fix?
I would think that's the most logical fix.
Right.
Rather than standing up a separate agency for purposes of CBSA, right? So then you're going to have all sorts of stand-up and institutional costs. The Arar Commission, as you may recall, the Arar Commission didn't want to have an all-of-government single reviewer that looked at both a police slash law enforcement and intelligence, because the fear was that that would encroach on police independence in the sense that you would have reviewers looking over the shoulders of ongoing investigations, or at least prospectively ongoing investigations.
Which is a reasonable concern.
And so you needed to have a review body that was attuned to police independence. And so it actually proposed that there be for the law enforcement bodies a separate body. And that body would have jurisdiction over the RCMP and CBSA. And so that was sensible. We've moved away, incidentally, from that recommendation to the extent that the RCMP's national security functions will be amenable to review by the new C-59 National Security Review Agency.
But again, the issue is here, like CBSA, I would say probably 97% of the stuff it does has to do with not terrorism.
Well, that's it.
Right? Like it's if and
that's true for the RCMP as well.
Yeah. So it's like, so, you know, there's drugs, there's...
Your complaints body for RCMP one day is just going to be dealing with the rude constable on the streets of British Columbia, and the next day is going to be dealing with some complicated national security investigation. It doesn't make a lot of sense necessarily to assume that those two functions have to be housed in the same institution. And so specialize in intelligence and security, fine, but then for the rest of the remit of those agencies, those law enforcement agencies, it makes a lot of sense to have a separate standing complaints and review agency.
Sounds good to me.
All right. So that's it for today. When we come back next day, we'll say a little bit about other things that we anticipate in 2018, some of which will come to pass, some of which probably won't. And also some updates on trials that we talked about over the course of 2017. And so thanks very much. And we'll see you next day.
See you next time.